Hello, and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. There is a story that we tell ourselves over and over again in the modern world. It's something that I noticed particularly this Christmas when I was watching loads and loads of Hallmark Christmas stories. Now, before you judge me too harshly, let me just say that I was in the midst of editing a chapter for my PhD. All I could see were footnotes and citations, and sometimes a girl just needs a good old-fashioned Hallmark show. Now, my mom and I had been watching these, and we started to notice that they have almost a fairy tale rhythm to them, a story that happens again and again. Usually starts with a girl who's working in an office job that she's not very happy with. She goes into the office early, exhausted, spills coffee on herself, and somehow or another, she ends up needing to take a trip away from her office job. Then she goes to some natural, beautiful place, whether it's a castle in the middle of Germany or somewhere in upstate New York or some relative's farm that she happens to have. There, she gets in touch with her real desires while she wrestles with nature. She realizes what she really wants. And somehow, from this magical experience, she discovers love, her true passions, and she returns to the city a changed woman, no longer under the threat of the corporate world. I started to notice that almost every single one of the shows had this kind of rhythm. But then, as I thought about it, I think I've seen that story in many other places. Whether it's rom-coms or actualization stories that we see in the movies, there is frequently this idea, the story that comes again and again, of someone who's wrapped in a mechanical, controlled corporate world, who goes out and encounters nature, gets in touch with their true selves and their true desires, and then has their lives changed. And I would like to suggest that the reason we tell ourselves the story over and over and over again is because at heart, all of us in the modern world and the modern secular West are romantics. And by romantics, I do not mean simply that we like roses at Valentine's Day or that we're particularly romantic people, but that we've all been deeply impacted by a historical movement that many of us don't even know that much about. The movement I'm talking about is Romanticism. Romanticism was a literary, musical, and intellectual movement that began in the late 18th century and early 19th century. It stood for desire, for beauty, for nature, for everything that was out of the bounds of rationality and industry. And, interestingly, many philosophers have said that many of the ways we think of the human person in our world come from Romanticism. Alan de Botton of the School of Life writes that the Romantic movement has permanently changed our sensibilities. As the world grows ever more technological and rational, Romanticism sticks up for the irrational, the untrained, the childlike, and the naive. As I've bumped into Romanticism in my studies, it's helped me make sense of much of the way we speak of what it means to be successful, to be self-actualized, and to be whole in the modern world. So I thought that this episode might be a good time to investigate the movement of Romanticism as a way that might actually help us understand ourselves. Romanticism was all about a feeling of alienation from nature, from our inner desires, and that feeling has come into our present world. But I wonder if maybe, by pressing into Romantics, we could see that that alienation is not just from nature, but from a more fundamental, spiritual part of our hearts. So, let's dive into exploring Romanticism this week through something visual, something musical, and something literary. Today, we'll be looking at the poetry of William Wordsworth. We'll be looking at a span of all the different romantic musical composers with my brother Joel, who will guide us through that. And then finally, we'll be looking at the Pre-Raphaelites and the way that Romanticism has eked and leaked into our present world. I have to admit to you all that I have loved putting this episode together, so I really hope that you will go check out the show notes at joyclarkson.com, where I've attached links to other resources and books and lots of beautiful images and playlists you can listen to, so go check that out at joyclarkson.com. And as ever, If you enjoy this episode, please don't forget to go leave a rating and review on iTunes and share it on whichever social media platform or email you would like to send it out to a friend on. And as ever, I want to issue a huge thank you to all of my Patreon supporters who keep me recording these podcasts and writing my PhD through your wonderful support. If you're interested in that, it's $10 or $2 a month, and you can always check it out at patreon.com/JoyClarkson. And also, I want to issue a huge thank you to the Anselm Society, a society in Colorado Springs that purposes to renew the Christian imagination in the arts and church. So without further ado, let's dive into this week's episode of Speaking with Joy. So, to me, Romanticism is the most important movement that you didn't study in school. But before we really dive into talking about specific art pieces, I wanted to kind of give you a background about what Romanticism was and what it came out of and what kind of its basic tenets were. Now, let me preface this with saying that if you're a Romantic scholar who happens to have stumbled into my podcast, that I'm sure that I will be painting with a very broad brush. The idea with this is not to get every nook and cranny of Romanticism, but just to understand what was the motivation behind it, what were some of the general tenets, and why did it take place, and how did it shape our world? While keeping in mind that Romanticism was a very diverse group, which when we talk about the musical artists, that will become more clear. There are so many different streams and branches, and anyway. But before we do all that, let's dive in just to kind of seeing what was Romanticism, where it come out of, and what's the history behind that. So, at its very most basic, Romanticism is a literary, artistic, and intellectual tradition that was responding to the rapidly changing cultural scene of the late 18th and early 19th century. So, in a world that at that point was increasingly ruled by rationalism and industrialism, that was kind of post-Enlightenment moving towards a sense of the dominance of science and industry. The Romantics kind of sought to reclaim the value of beauty and nature and imagination that they thought was being lost. So Charles Taylor, who is that wonderful writer of the secular age, in his book The Sources of the Self, says that Romanticism was mainly, if you're going to try to characterize it, a rebellion against the construction of neoclassical norms in art, and especially literature, against the classical stress on rationalism, tradition, and formal harmony. The Romantics affirmed the rights of the individual, of the imaginative, and of feeling. So, kind of to break that down, I would say that Romanticism was specifically responding to three kind of historic changes that were overturning society at this point. The first one was the Industrial Revolution. So, you've probably heard about this at some point along in your history studies, but the Industrial Revolution took place from around 1820 to 1845, and it was really when society started moving away from agrarian forms of life, so more farming, and where most people either lived in the cities or they lived really as farmers in kind of more agrarian lifestyles with smaller communities, towards a world in which a lot was done through machines. We started to get transports. This is when you have in 1825, the Stockton and Darlington Railway, which was kind of this crazy thing because all of a sudden you could travel and ship huge amounts of product. And then you had a lot of things like textile factories. Rather than having people do individual looms, they could start to have these huge factories that produced mass-produced stuff. So that's the Industrial Revolution. And it totally changed the economy, it changed the countries. And it's interesting to note that a lot of this actually came out of England. So a lot of the Industrial Revolution came from technology that was taking place in England. And so the Romantics, a lot of them are coming out of Germany, but a lot of the kind of poets we think of come out of England as well. So it's interesting that's all kind of taking place in the same place. So to give you a sense of the hugeness of the Industrial Revolution, this is very basic. You can find this on Wikipedia. But in 1781, cotton was mainly spun by individual people. So it was a pretty big industry, but it would be spun by my family who had my very own loom. It wasn't a factory. It was just, I was spinning it and then I would sell it to people who would sell it. But by 1800, once this started to be able to be created more in a more machine oriented way, it went from 5.1 million pounds of cotton being spun in 1781 to 56 million pounds by 1800. So that is over a tenfold increase. And that was just the very, very beginning. So you started to see this intense ability to create more and more stuff. And that meant cheaper clothes, but it also meant it had to travel. So you had steam trains. So that this was this huge cultural thing. But because of that, you had this whole new industry created, hence the Industrial Revolution, people started to move away from agrarian lifestyles towards kind of factory lifestyles. So you have this huge influx of suburban workers. So people aren't just living in the countryside, they start all clustering around these factories and these places, which also led to an unprecedented amount of pollution and of poverty. So if you wanted kind of a picture of what the Industrial Revolution looked like, go watch the BBC miniseries or read the book by Elizabeth Gaskell, North and South. This is a real picture of what the Industrial Revolution brought. It brought families that were from, they were not nobility, they were not anything special, but they became very, very wealthy. It brought jobs for people, but it also brought huge amounts of poverty and pollution. So this is happening. It's making immense amount of wealth. It's making things cheaper, but it's also creating poverty and pollution. And this is a huge thing that's happening, particularly in England. And that comes along with the railroad and stuff as well. The second thing it's responding to, and I'll tell you how it's responding, is the emphasis on rationalism that kind of rose from what we'd think of as the Enlightenment. So from like 1600 to 1800. Ish. Again, I'm painting with a very broad brush. And rationalism is the view that reason is the chief source of our ability to know. So we can understand things through pure logic, and we can think through things rationally. The role of belief, of tradition, of desires and emotions is kind of downplayed or considered unreliable. And important figures in this development of rationalism are people like Descartes, who said, I think, therefore I am. He was in 1596, 1650. And then you have people like Baruch Spinoza, Gottfried Leibniz, I always say that wrong, and Immanuel Kant. And all of these really emphasize the role of reason. And they found a lot of the romance and the, you know, passionate religiosity of medievalism too. That's why they called it the Dark Ages. It's really a misnomer to call medievalism and the era of medieval, the Dark Ages. There was a lot that was happening then. But according to these people, because they were emphasizing rationalism, it was the Dark Ages because it was the age of faith. So you have this real emphasis on reason, a rejection of the emotional, of the religious, of the spiritual. And then you also have this movement called Neoclassicism, which takes place from around 1760 to 1850-ish. And Neoclassicism is basically an artistic expression of the emphasis on rationalism, though it can differ depending on whether it's in or outside of religious circles. And this was an artistic movement that really emphasized order and proportionality and reason and kind of the heights of men's ability to create and control. And it's also called Neoclassicism because a lot of it was referencing back to Roman and Greek, like the classical world. So it was a lot of Greek myths and all these different things. It was seen as kind of the height, the Greek and Roman was seen as the height of secular reasoning. So that was part of why it was being referenced back to, was kind of this emphasis on look what man can do when we emphasize reason and order and all these different things. So the Romantics were pretty upset by all of this. They wanted to react against the idea that the world ought to be only industrial. They looked at the countryside. They saw, they were kind of some of the first environmentalists, if you want to think of it that way. They saw the soot and the poverty that was being created by this influx of industry. And they worried that man's desire to control would ruin that the beauty of nature and the beauty that gave us our life. They saw the emphasis on rationalism and they felt like there was this huge amount of life and a faith, and not faith in the traditional sense, as we'll see later, but they thought there was something lost in focusing only on what takes place in our heads and not in the lived experiences of our communities and not only in the experience of our desires. And they saw neoclassicism as kind of trying to pinpoint beauty into these very controlled and very contained boxes. So what, as a movement, Romanticism did was it tried to recover a sense of glory in nature that was present, they thought, in medieval world, but even also in the Pietists, the German Pietists, to recover a sense of the fact that man destroys what he controls. And so trying to celebrate the uncontrollable, the beautiful. If you listened to our podcast on Wendell Berry and on the dangers of imagining things as machines, they would very much be along those lines. They wanted to celebrate nature and childlikeness. And they wanted to break out of that. So their art focused on nature, on desires, on tapping into the individual and to freedom, and emphasizing the role of imagination, and that there was something beyond only the rational world that should be celebrated. Essentially, they were worried about the flatness of how the world was being imagined. They felt that the world was being imagined as something that could be decided in a committee, that was rational, that was controlled, and they felt that a great deal was being lost in that conception of the world. Okay, so that's kind of the background of what it was the Romantics were responding to, these huge kind of cultural changes that were afoot in the 18th century and 19th century. So now let's dive into looking at some specific pieces that will help us understand more how this relates to us in the modern world. So we're going to start by looking at William Wordsworth, who is one of the Romantic poets. And I have to say that part of the reason I love him so dearly is because I got to visit his house when I went to the Lake District. The Lake District, everyone should be a romantic and love nature if you go to the Lake District. It is absolutely beautiful. It's rolling hills. It's kind of stark and cold depending on when you go, but it's glorious. And this is where William Wordsworth is from. He was born in 1770 and lived until 1850, so he's kind of right in the center of when we would think of Romanticism as taking place, and most of his poetry has to do with nature and desire and beauty. Okay, so without saying anything further, I'm going to start by reading you a poem of his that I think really captures the thrust of Romanticism. It's called Lines Written in Early Spring. He says, "I heard a thousand blended notes while in a grove I sat reclined. In that sweet mood when pleasant thoughts bring sad thoughts to the mind. To her fair works did nature link the human soul that through me ran, and much it grieved my heart to think what man has made of man. Through primrose tufts in that sweet bower the periwinkle trailed its wreaths, and 'tis my faith that every flower enjoys the air it breathes. The birds around me hopped and played, their thoughts I cannot measure, but the least motion which they made, it seemed a thrill of pleasure. The budding twigs spread out their fan to catch the breezy air, and I must think, do all I can, that there was pleasure there. If this belief from heaven be sent, if such be nature's holy plan, have I not reason to lament what man has made of man?" Oh, it is such a good poem, and I remember reading it actually when I was fairly young and just feeling a kinship with it, feeling an understanding of that ache when he says, should I not lament what man has made of man? So I want to connect this to when I was just telling you about the ways that people were watching the landscape be changed by industrialism and by this kind of trying to dominate nature rather than to celebrate and enjoy it. And if you think of Wordsworth enjoying his beauteous home in the glorious Lake District, and then going and seeing the railroad and seeing these places that were polluted and full of poverty, he's really seeing that and writing about that. But it's more than that. It's not just his kind of sadness about industrialism. It seems like he's almost connecting that to this kind of almost human fallenness. It's almost like he's rearticulating what it is to be sinful, if we were to use more traditional Christian language. And I think that that relates back to kind of what happens in Romanticism, which is that they reimagine the human person. They reimagine the problem of the human condition or the problem of sin. And they also come up with a different kind of salvation. And this kind of model of understanding the human person and what's wrong with us and how we can be saved is very much tied to Christianity, but it's also kind of loosed from its moorings. So let's talk a little bit about that. In his book, Poetic Theology, William Dyrnes writes that Romanticism has developed a discourse and a register of feeling that has come to define the modern self. But I don't want to suggest that these writers and poets were saying was altogether new. In an important sense, Romantic authors were simply retrieving and elaborating a tradition of feeling and associated practices that were indebted to German pietists, and beyond these, to the medieval mystics. Okay, so what is direness talking about? How does this relate to William Wordsworth? Basically, as I was saying, the Romantics felt like they were trying to reclaim something that had been lost. And it was kind of lost, I think, in two ways in their minds. It was first lost through the Reformation, because during the Reformation, in a desire to kind of cut off what was perceived as the idolatry of the gaudy medieval churches with all of their saint statues and crucifixes, the churches a lot of times kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, and they whitewashed the churches, they didn't have prayer services as often, they crushed stained glass, and they even changed the way that music was sung so that many Calvinist churches could only sing hymns that were all only had one note per word, because more than that might make you too emotional. And again, this was reacting to some decadence, but it kind of erased the tradition of beauty that was also meant to kind of awaken the soul to God's beauty. And it was this really rich tradition of seeing God and beauty and everything that was supposed to awaken the soul. So there was a sense that even if the Reformation was corrective, it was overcorrective, and it kind of crushed a lot of the beauty and the tradition and the beauty of that in practice and in art. And of course, there's exceptions to that, like the German Pietists, like a lot of the choral tradition in Anglicanism, but that was the sense that was lost on the one side. And then on the other side, there was the sense that with kind of the secular force of really an emphasis on rationalism that was coming out of the Enlightenment, there was this loss of the value of feeling and of desire and of the religious and the spiritual. And so they kind of wanted to go back in and reclaim that. And so they did try to recover the emotional register of, you could kind of think of the Pietists, so that's like some of the people like Bach, or the medieval mystics. But they had one problem, which was that for the most part, many of the Romantics rejected religion or just kind of displaced it. So it wasn't really rooted in Christianity. So they were really attempting to recover the emotions of mysticism, of pietism, while rejecting the beliefs behind it. So what you ended up with was this kind of odd new pseudo-religion that you could kind of define like this. In medieval mysticism, we are all drawn towards God. That's why we see the ultimate, that's the direction of the soul to be drawn in. With this displaced in Romanticism, we're all drawn towards nature. We're all made for union with nature. In medieval mysticism, you have this emphasis on the cross, that the cross is the way towards union with God, that we're all drawn, we all long for union with God, and the cross is the way to that. Because you displace that in Romanticism, you end up with this emphasis on death. And that's kind of related to nature, because everything in nature dies, and so the way to really be at one with nature is through death. And either that will end in some kind of transcendence, or it might be despair. So really, what this recharacterizes it is that instead of union with God, we long for harmony with nature. And instead of a desire for union with God, we desire harmony with nature. And so what salvation looks like begins to be a little bit different. So instead of thinking of the kind of the traditional sense of salvation in which we recognize the image of God within us and are reconciled with God through Christ and through the cross, a romantic understanding kind of the human condition would be that we recognize the natural man that has to be unearthed and released, and where the desires can be in harmony with nature, and that then we'll be reconciled with nature and beauty. And that will be that. So with that in mind, let's look back to this Wordsworth poem. It's interesting because a lot of this, and I will say that not all the Romantics, it would be wrong to say all the Romantics were not religious, because Wordsworth was really mostly an Anglican most of his life, and he never totally left that, although he was a little bit more dicey than someone like Coleridge, who was a really faithful Anglican. But he uses all of this very religious language, but you will note that at the end, he says, "If this belief from heaven be sent," which is very traditionally Christian, "if such be nature's holy plan." So instead of saying God's holy plan, there's this idea that nature has this inherent kind of telos and meaning. "Have I not reason to lament what man is made of man?" So if you think about this as kind of like a description of the problem of the human condition in a romantic sense, rather than saying the problem with mankind is that we are not in relationship with God and we're not reconciled with God in God's plans, it's saying we are no longer reconciled in relationship with nature's holy plan, which means that to be in relationship, we would have to just become like nature, which is, that's where you kind of get this emphasis in Romanticism of kind of the childlike or the natural, which you sometimes also get this idea that you need to give in to all of your desires and You get some of the free love movement out of this because we're just trying to be reconciled to nature. And if you think that that's really the fallen part of humankind, then that kind of begins to make sense. So I hope that maybe in your mind, this is starting to connect to why this impacts us in the modern world. Think about the story I told you at the very beginning. We talked about a girl who's caught in the corporate world, who spills coffee on herself, who's out of touch with her desires and her true wants. And then she goes into nature and she experiences some kind of transformation where she suddenly realizes what she wants, where she's in the wild and she's able to have a transformation. A lot of that's coming from this kind of romantic sense that our problem is that we are out of touch with our natural selves, that we need to unearth the desires and the true self that's within us so that we can live in harmony with our desires and with nature, and that this would really be salvation. Now, of course, the thing that's different about this than Christianity is that it assumes that if we could really unearth all those desires, they would all be good desires. And so to be whole would just be to unearth our desires and then to follow them. And that's a lot of what we see in today's world about how we would articulate what it means to be self-actualized or to be whole. It would be to find out what your desires are, and as long as they don't hurt anyone, to do them. So a lot of that is coming out of this romantic sensibility. And we'll unpick how this has had a lot of troublesome repercussions in our world, as we've seen this kind of self-actualization being the only thing that is worthwhile for our salvation and how that becomes toxic. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that the Romantics were onto something in many ways. They were some of the first people to issue the warning call saying that maybe just dominating nature is not a good idea. Maybe if we dominate nature, we will destroy it, and it will in turn cause our lives to be very difficult. They also were onto something with realizing that rationalism really doesn't capture the full breadth of the human experience and that it assumes far too much of itself. So for that, I will say thank you very much, the Romantics. Before we dive into the musical examples, I would tell you that if you wanted to know more about the kind of philosophical underpinnings of the Romantic tradition, particularly with literary sense, you could look to people like Schiller and Goethe and Novalis, and they were all kind of the philosophical underpinnings of everything that I just told you, particularly Schiller. He really articulated basically what I just articulated to you. So you can go check that out if you're a reader. But without further ado, let's go on to our next section, which will be looking at the role of romanticism in musical composition throughout the 19th century. So now, in this segment, I have with me someone who you will know if you listened to last week's episode.
Hi.
This is Joel.
It's Joel. Hey there, everyone.
Joel, you do music-y things, don't you? As everyone knows from last week. But tell them, just in case, they didn't listen to last week's.
I'm a composer, and as Joy says, I write music-y things.
You write music-y things for churches, for films, for our band, The Two Benedictions.
That's right.
And he is my resident go-to musical advisor when it comes to speaking with Joy. So I'm going to kind of quiz you on, I just want to hear about the history of Romanticism when it comes to music. But one thing I wanted to quickly say before, that's kind of connected to the last segment, is that part of what's important in Romanticism when it comes to art is not just kind of the intellectual tradition it's coming about or the meaning that it has, but what it's doing for the people who listen to it. Because if the idea is that we are out of touch with nature, we're not in harmony with our natural selves, the desires that we have within, part of the role of art, and Schiller writes about this a lot, is to awaken our affections, our desires, and to put them back in contact with nature. And so the artist almost becomes like a priest, like a teacher, but also like a priest, because they kind of mediate nature's elan and its flow into the person. And so we start to kind of idealize artists. We idealize them as priests who can connect us, in which case you start to see kind of Christ figure artists, which also means that they die. So I just wanted to kind of preface that as we begin to talk about the history of musical artists and romanticism and how that crops up. So with that said, just give us kind of a broad sense of what was happening in romanticism with concern to music.
It sort of vaguely goes along with some of what's going on in Romanticism with literature, and there's actually a lot of crossover, but you can sort of look at Beethoven as a sort of linchpin, as sort of a hinge, perhaps, between classical era and Romantic era music. Beethoven, even in his own, in the midst of his own career, kind of has a divide, sort of like a continental divide between his earlier music, which is more classical, and then his later music, which is more Romantic. And he sort of, in his own way, represents the Romantic ideal, early Romantic ideal of this artist who becomes sort of, he triumphs through his own sense of self. And this is sort of, it emerges from an episode in his life. In which it's called the Heiligenstadt Testament, and it's a letter he writes to his brothers after realizing he's going deaf, that he's slowly losing his hearing, and he becomes very despairing and considers suicide, and he talks to his brothers about this, and then he says, and I've decided instead to sort of overcome this feeling of suicide by living for my art instead and sort of living into my art. And, you know, from this comes many of his greatest works, including the Ninth Symphony, which of course has the Ode to Joy in it as well, which is adapted from Schiller. And so there is, right, with even with Beethoven, right at the beginning of Romantic music, there's this interplay between literature and music in that sense, between the text and Romanticism and music. And this continues to sort of develop. You get another really early model of sort of the dying artist who sort of gives himself over to their music in Schubert, who writes all this beautiful Lieder, German songs. He writes a number of German songs. This is what he's known for, is his beautiful, beautiful German songs. And he contracts an illness and dies at 28. So he sort of represents, in an early sense, this artist
who is... A lot of the diseases which people contracted and died of early would be connected with giving into their desires that nature gave.
Indeed, yes. And his disease, which ultimately he succumbs to, is indeed related to that. And so there's sort of this model that's already starting to grow in musicians, that's embodied by the musicians themselves, of this sort of pure artist. And so Romanticism continues to grow through people like Robert Schumann, who becomes a very central figure in sort of mid-19th century Romanticism. And Schumann is actually sort of the space in which it begins to diverge, because Schumann was known for being an immensely respected music critic, but also being a conductor and a composer. And he actually ends up going crazy quite young and dies in a mental asylum. And his wife, Clara Schumann, is a close friend of Brahms, of Johannes Brahms, who becomes one of the central figures on one side of a split in composers and German composers in the middle of the 19th century. On the one hand, you have people like Liszt, who and Wagner, who sort of fall into what ends up being called the New German School, which effectively what they mean by that is that they are seeing Handel and Bach as sort of the old German school, as it were, and they're sort of establishing this new sound. And they think Romanticism is sort of this, although they may not use that exact term, they see themselves as sort of in the middle of this new development of this German sensibility. On the other side of things, you have people like Schumann and Clara Schumann and Brahms, who are wanting to continue the tradition that has been established through many of these German composers. And they each see Beethoven kind of as an apex of a sort. The new German school, Wagner and Liszt, see him kind of as the final moment of sort of this change, this moving into this new expression and opening up this possibility to sort of emerge out of what the old German school represented into something new. The other side, people like Brahms would have seen Beethoven sort of as the zenith of the classical expression, and that they want to sort of continue in that tradition. And so there's this divide between the two, and it sort of centers on this question of tradition, so they can't get around and sort of move beyond tradition. And so with people like Wagner, of course, you see the very quintessential, what I think you've probably already talked about, the quintessential romantic notion, which is he writes these broad, massive operas that take these medieval themes, like in Parsifal, for instance. He's dealing with a lot of Christological imagery and a lot of imagery about sacrifice, but he sort of nobilizes death. And that's what his intention is. So he's removing a lot of the orthodoxy, and he creates his own vision of death and self-sacrifice and such through Parsifal that sort of nobilizes death in this sense. Whereas Brahms, on the other hand, you have an example of somebody who is, you know, if you look at his choral works, they're all within the Lutheran tradition. He's working with the Lutheran Bible. He knew his Lutheran Bible front to back. Mm-hmm. He read it almost every day. He was very, very dedicated to it. And he's actually maintaining not just the form of mm-hmm. religion and what it does, but also the content. And so you have this sense in which, you know, Brahms is preserving that ultimately, I think, the at least within German Romanticism, those who are sort of wanting to envision this new vision of Romanticism went out. Because, mm-hmm. you know, towards the end of the century, you see people like Mahler, who in his Resurrection Symphony, he sort of presents this vision, not unlike what Wagner is doing, mm-hmm. but in his own sort of stylistic terms, of resurrection. But it's very esoteric, jarring. Very abstract. Well, it's very beautiful, but it doesn't mm-hmm. have the specificity of the connectivity to what brings about the resurrection and
it's
what gives
not,
it
it's not
purpose
put your
meaning.
Hand in my side and put no, your hand
no,
in my wounds.
No,
it's
no,
kind
it's
of
just
vague.
A soaring human sort of achievement, as it were.
Which is a picture of what art is to Romanticism. It's this right. picture of achievement and beyond.
Absolutely, yeah. And interestingly enough, if you think about it, the next sort of movement within German music is the Second Viennese School, which is Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, all of whom were writing within what we call the 12-tone system, which is an attempt to sort of decentralize the tonal aspect of Western music and try to create something new that for them would probably express something of this sort of despair that's starting to grow mm-hmm. in the German middle class and or about it. And so there's it sort of collapses on itself. Romanticism mm-hmm. sort of collapses in on itself in that sense and into this new movement.
Yes, and something that if I want to kind of connect this as how we can start to see this play out in the present day, and then I want to ask you about Brahms' Requiem, which is that through this whole period of time, a lot of the people you've described had these sort of tragic lives. Mm-hmm. They were seen, they made these absolutely beautiful, I love romantic music because it is beauty for beauty's sake in yeah. many senses. It's yeah. it's gorgeous, it mm-hmm. focuses on awakening emotions, and it does that well, but then you have these composers who die by suicide, die going crazy young, and you begin to have this kind of, and this actually happens in art as well, this picture of the artist who has given himself to the art to the point that he dies young because he can't do this. And it's kind of this picture of the Christ figure, if you've displaced all of the religious elements, mm-hmm. If art is the thing that allows us to reconnect with nature, then the artist is the Christ figure and the artist has to die. And you right. start to see that reconnected in the way Alan de Botton connects this to people like the many artists that we have that all died at 26, like Jeff Buckley. And mm-hmm. and it's kind of a sad trope, but it's this picture of yeah. if we put all of the weight of spiritual awakening and self-actualization onto our artists, we begin to yeah. have this trope of the suicidal artist.
Yeah.
Which is distressing.
It's very distressing.
And it is not something we should support or endorse.
No, but it makes sense because it's necessary. It becomes yes. necessary because something needs to take the place of what is a transcendent
them, yeah.
truth.
They become the cross through which we are able to connect with our true selves, with nature,
yeah.
Rather than Jesus, which is really quite upsetting.
Yeah,
but it is
but
necessary. Yeah, it's necessary yeah. and it's understandable according to the way yeah, that they're thinking.
Absolutely.
So the thing I wanted to end on is we're going to end, I'm going to play a bit from the Requiem for them, mm-hmm. but I want you to tell them a bit about the Requiem, because I think that even while we can kind of talk about the displacement of the Christ figure and things, there is in the midst of Romanticism, it is based in the emotional register and in the language and in the desires present in the tradition, mm-hmm. in Christian tradition.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, like in poetry, you have Coleridge emerges, who is a faithful Anglican, mm-hmm. and he does love God, and he sees Romanticism as a way to come in contact with desire, yes, but that desire leads us to God. Mm-hmm. And I think that in music, too, you have people who pop up who are not just this kind of yeah. rootless. So tell us a little bit about Brahms and the Requiem, because I know there's a lot yeah. of controversy over that.
Yeah, so I think Brahms is really fascinating. I would say that Brahms kind of becomes the battleground upon which these questions of Romanticism are fought, and not just in terms of what was happening at the time, but the way people look back at Romanticism mm. and try to understand.
Reinterpret it.
Yeah, yeah, because with the Requiem, the German Requiem is an interesting piece because it is, you know, the traditional Requiem in a classical sense, which, mm-hmm. again, Brahms cared about the classical tradition, mm-hmm. so he's working within it. It would have been based off of the actual liturgy of the Requiem Mass.
It would have been a Mass, yeah.
It would have been a Mass, yeah, and he sort of changes this. He sort of does his own thing. He uses scripture. He places himself at the center, in a sense. He lets the question not become about the fear of death, but rather about those who are still living, who have to deal with the loss of death. And this is important because this is a theme that shows up a lot in his life. He, you know, early, Robert Schumann, of course, dies very early, and this is, just shakes him to his core, and that's actually what starts the writing of the Requiem. It takes about 10 years for him to write the Requiem, and it moves very quickly after the death of his mother, who he was very close to. And so there's a very personal aspect to the Requiem for Brahms, and he uses to sort of imagine his space within this German Requiem, which he wanted to be a Requiem for the people. He sort of went back and forth on different kinds of names for the Requiem, and he ultimately decided on the German Requiem, the Deutsche Requiem. But he's wanting to place himself as a person who's still living, having to deal with the grief of loss and wondering where this person is that he has lost, where they've become hidden, you know. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a battleground in some ways. The reason I use that phrase is because many people look at that hiddenness. There's one character in this Requiem who is very obviously and conspicuously removed from many of the texts, and that's Christ. Christ is not present by and large. His words are present. He's implied multiple times, but there's no explicit reference to Christ anywhere in the entire Requiem, even though there is reference to the bodily resurrection, and there's reference to sort of this idea of being planted as a seed and coming back, you know, as this, unless a seed fall into the ground and die. So a lot of people have interpreted this as Brahms trying to secularize the Requiem, as him trying to sort of like remove the Christological center from the Requiem. I don't personally think that's true. I think that there's two things going on. One, he's working within a tradition of Lutheranism about the hiddenness of Christ. So he's very much within a theological Lutheran space already, which is it has a long theological history. And then secondly, he's doing what romantics do. He's saying, my mother is hidden from me. Robert Schumann is hidden from me. Christ is hidden from me. He's not denying Christ. Christ is hidden from him. And
he's
so
reckoning with his own true emotions.
Yeah, he's trying to get at where is God in the midst of this. And the Requiem isn't, I think, in a sense, doing that. And I think I almost wonder if part of the reason he doesn't reveal Christ is not because Christ isn't there, but because it would cheapen the closeness that we actually end up achieving through listening to the Requiem to Christ by making it this explicit sort of doctrinal
teachy thing.
He wants to do romantic thing. He wants us to feel. Yeah. And so I think, and this is why it's a battleground, because you have people who look on both sides of it and say, on the one hand, it's very romantic and he's, you know, he's stripping it of all sort of the religious center of it. But I think there's also people on the other hand who would say, no, there's a sense in which there is very much a Christological presence, but he's doing it through a very careful, thoughtful lens, and he's working his own faith out. And I think, interestingly enough, you started this session with the clip of Dream of Gerontius. I think actually Elgar is doing much of the same thing. He's working his Catholic faith out through a romantic lens, because the Dream of Gerontius is this poem, and I'll be brief about this, but the Dream of Gerontius is this poem that John Henry Newman, one of the great sort of apologists, Christian apologists, in the middle of the 19th century writes. And it's meant to be sort of this
preparation for death.
Yeah, it's a reimagining of the morality tale, of the morality play, and there's this good man who's basically facing death.
And we've done a podcast on it.
We have. So please go back and listen to that. Please, you'll get even more rich understanding of it from that. But I think Wagner is doing the same thing, because he truncates it significantly. He focuses especially on the death of the man.
And, you mean Elgar.
I mean Elgar, thank you. Yeah, he truncates it a lot, the actual text, especially the part that has to do with the man being in heaven and going through through sort of watching different things happen and then going to purgatory. He shortens that bit and really focuses in much more on the text that Newman wrote about the man actually dying. And he uses a lot of very Wagnerian kinds of music to do it. And so I think, in a sense, he's using romantic themes, romantic means to sort of express his desire to grapple with his Catholic faith, which he definitely in the historical record has a lot of struggle with.
Yes, and I think that that makes sense, though, because romanticism isn't emerging out of nowhere. It is, in many ways, trying to reclaim the emotional tenor and even the religious practices that were present before the Reformation.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that we would see these kind of moments of bursting out of hope and of a Christian hope, even.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we're going to play a section from Brahms' Requiem before diving into our final section today.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that beautiful segment from Brahms' Requiem. It is a passage that is taken from John 16, 22 through 24, which reads, "Now your time is of grief, but I will see you again, and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy." And it's interesting because as Joel was talking about the hiddenness of Christ, these are the words of Christ to Brahms, but sung through a woman's voice, through the voice of his mother who is hidden from him. And I think this is a perfect picture of kind of the ways in which so much of Romanticism gestures towards a longing for transcendence and for God, but that we experience it through these normal things in the world. And that leads us to another important group of women in Romanticism who will be our final example and our visual example, which are the Pre-Raphaelites. Now, I shouldn't exactly say it's of women, because the paintings are of women, but the painters were not. The Pre-Raphaelites actually started with the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, which was a group of English painters and poets founded in 1848 by William Holman Hunt, John Everett Millais, and Dante Gabriel Rossetti, and then they were joined later by a few others. And they were a group who had similar romantic ideals like we've talked about. They rejected specifically the classical mode of art, which saw everything being structured with classical poses, and they wanted to get back to what they saw as kind of a medieval or a literally pre-Raphaelite, so before Raphael, before all the classicalness slipped into Italy, and tap into the beauty of that tradition. In their early declarations, they had four doctrines which they wanted to express. One was to have genuine ideas to express, whatever that means, I hope I have them. Two was to study nature attentively so as to know how to express it. So you can see this connection with Romanticism, their desire to come into contact and be at one with nature. Three, to sympathize with what is direct and serious and heartfelt and previous art, to the exclusion of what is conventional, self-parading, and learned by rote, so it's trying to get in contact with the emotions and desires. And fourth, most indispensable of all, to produce thoroughly good pictures and statues. So these were kind of their very romantic endeavors. They wanted to get outside of the classical kind of emotionless, rationalistic art and portray things that were beautiful, that moved people, and that reckoned back and hearkened back to a sense of the beautiful in nature. And one of the things that was featured prominently in their art was that it was often very medieval in nature, that especially took on later in the movement. And it often featured many of these very kind of beautiful, ethereal, pre-Raphaelite women. That's kind of what are known for. And at some point, I'm going to interview my friend Rebecca Lamb, who's kind of an expert on much of this, about the role that the women played in their lives, the muses who were the models for all of these women. But there was this desire for them to capture kind of an honorability of womanhood, of its life-givingness, of its wildness. And so you had all of these gorgeous paintings, which go on joyclarkson.com, and you can see them, that are that really depict these beautiful women, often with reference to the medieval era. And I think it's so interesting that it's always trying to pick up on the medieval, because that was the time when they identified their last having been this kind of emotional, beautiful relationship to art. And so they hearkened back to that, but again, it was mostly the mythic and the story without as much of the reference to Christianity. And the specific artist I put lots of pictures on in this one is actually somebody who was after the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, but who was still painting in this tradition, who is an artist that I absolutely enjoy. I've had his paintings in my room for a long time, called John William Waterhouse. And part of the reason that I picked him is because he is a really good example of the ways in which it strayed away from classicism. So John William Waterhouse, who lived, I don't have his dates right here, but I know he painted from at least the 1870s until the 19-teens. So that's a span of nearly 50 years. And it's interesting because in his early years, he paints some of the same subjects over and over again. So one of the subjects he paints over and over again is Miranda. From The Tempest by Shakespeare. And Miranda's the daughter of this person, and she lives on an island, and she's watching for shipwrecks. And the first painting I have on here is in 1875, and she looks very classical. If you want an example of neoclassicism, this has some romantic elements, but it's really pretty neoclassical. She's posed in a Roman way, she has a Roman hairstyle, she's wearing a toga, for goodness sakes, her hair is nicely done up. And then if you look at the same subject of a painting,
which is also Miranda, but 41 years later, in 1916, you can see what Romanticism has done and how this is expressed through Paraphilites, because the scene is about 50 times more dramatic, you know, and the other one you have kind of like, there's a tiny wave and the water is a bit dark and there's some dark clouds. In this new one, you have these huge waves that go up like 3/4 of the way through the painting and a ship that's literally cracking in half as she's watching the shipwreck. And Miranda, instead of this kind of docile girl with her hair up wearing a toga, is wearing a medieval dress. And her hair is bright red. She's having to hold it back because the wind is so strong. And she's gazing with great emotion and worry and distress over this shipwreck. So he's a really good example of kind of the way that Romanticism worked. Early in his life, he painted more neoclassical paintings with this kind of, you know, reprieve and order and reference to Rome and to Greek myths. And now you have this passionate, medieval, emotional painting. And that's really what they wanted to evoke in this. But the reason I bring them up is because we've talked a lot about how Romanticism translates into our sense of what it is to be a human and what it is to be saved. We talked about that with Wordsworth. And with Joel, we talked about kind of the romantic ideals of what it is to be an artist and how we see that in our days. But now with what I think is really fun about the Pre-Raphaelites is that we can see how tropes and images and even just styles of the Pre-Raphaelites and of the Romantics have evolved into our time when you compare the Pre-Raphaelite women with someone like Lord of the Rings and all of the women in that. And so I've attached a whole bunch of images in the blog post of the ways in which the Lord of the Rings models Eowyn and Arwen, their dresses, their scenes in which, oh my gosh, the beautiful set design. They look like a Pre-Raphaelite painting. And the first person to point this out to me was Rebecca Lamb, Dr. Rebecca Lamb. And I want to talk to her more about it at some point. But it's very obvious as soon as someone says that, you go, oh my gosh, of course, that's true. That they're modeling it after this, all these Pre-Raphaelite paintings, from the colors they use to the dresses to the ways, even just that the environments look. It's very, very similar to the Pre-Raphaelite. So go look on my page and you can see the way that's happening. But the reason I think that's important is that it shows us one more time how many ways in which Romanticism has slipped itself into the way that we live, the way that we consider ourselves, and even the way that we do art. So as this episode comes to a close, I want to leave you with three thoughts, three things I hope that you will have taken away from this episode. The first is that I hope that this episode will have helped you understand our world a little bit better. That you'll understand how the ways that we think of ourselves, that story from Hallmark about trying to come in contact with our true selves by going out to nature, which unearths all our desires, that that's not coming from nowhere. That comes from a history of people trying to reawaken the emotions, tapping into religious longings, but unrooting them from their religious foundations. I hope that you'll be able to see the ways in which this narrative plays itself over and over again in our culture, and that you'll start to kind of pinpoint it and say, that's not necessarily Christianity, or that's not necessarily just secularism, that's Romanticism. That is tapping into the desire to escape the rationalistic, industrial world that we live in. The second thing is that I hope that you will take away a warning from Romanticism. While there is much that is good and beautiful in Romanticism, it's also obvious that the pressure of Romanticism to discover our true selves, to be an artist who can bring the elan of nature into the world and reconnect us to nature, can be deadly. Artists are not priests. They are humans. They are craftsmen. We should not expect them to give us all of our metaphysical desires and in so doing create this kind of trope of the suicidal artist that we see over and over again. We should also take note that the artist's idea that they all had, that we just needed to come in contact with our desires and live into all of them because nature couldn't give us bad desires and nature is our God, was definitely not true. Even in the lives of the artists themselves, you can see so much heartache and pain and even just death from the foolishness of their decisions. So we can see that we should take a warning from them, that we shouldn't let the romantic idea that we simply need to follow our desires to be happy infiltrate our lives and make us make foolish and suicidal decisions. But finally, that we should take some hope in knowing that the romantic self is really the modern self. If it's true that the romantic ideal has slipped into our cultural conscience, that we all are longing to discover our true selves, to be at one with nature, this is a really kind of prevalent theme in a lot of the more secular culture. We could be very sad about it and say, well, it's all very bad. And on the one hand, there are elements of it that aren't good and that we need to correct, that we need to think well about. But we should also take hope. I think that the Romantics were right when they noted that a world that only focuses on rationalism and on industry and on things that we can control and understand misses out on an openness to the transcendent and an openness to God. And as long as our culture retains this grain of romanticism, a grain of a hope to be united with the ways of nature, a grain of hoping to discover what is true inside, as long as they remain open to that, we remain open to a good desire, a desire that might lead us to God. I love the quote from C.S. Lewis where he says, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at sea. We are far too easily pleased." And I think that this is true of Romanticism. The problem was not that they emphasized desire too much, but that they thought smaller things and the wrong things could fulfill the inherent and eternal desires we have within us. They thought we could fulfill our desires by pursuing romantic relationships left and right, or by following all of our sensual pleasures, when obviously that does lead to disappointment and to pain. Or they thought that we could follow our desires into nature, but nature itself is bound up in death and in disappointment, and even nature itself can fail. But if we could follow those desires further, if we could let all of the beauty of Brahms and Coleridge and Wordsworth and Blake awaken us to a desire for something that could truly satisfy us, well, then I think there's still hope left in the world. So there you have it, folks. We are all romantics, and that's a good and a bad thing, but mostly it's just a thing. I hope that you've enjoyed this episode. If you did, please don't forget to go leave a rating and review and to share it with a friend anywhere you'd like. And I'd also like to encourage you, any of you patrons, to go on and check out the podcast that I'll be recording, where I'll read some more of my favorite romantic poetry, because I just couldn't fit it all into today's episode. I'm so thankful for you all, and I look forward to talking to you next week on Speaking with Joy.